Transfer Tuesday on the Pick Six podcast. Hello, everybody. I'm Sam McCune along with Evan Bland. Yes, we've reversed the order because we're going to talk about Nebraska baseball in a minute. Jimmy Watkins will join us in a minute to talk about why Marcus Washington transferred to Nebraska. That happened today. Washington, the Texas player who, as we may recall, was connected to Nebraska about 5 years ago with Mike Riley. He transferred to Nebraska. That now makes 15 transfers for the Huskers. Midway through this podcast, we are going to have a transfer draft where all three of us, Jimmy, Evan, and myself, have five players each, and we draft. Evan gets the first pick. He won Paper, Rock, Scissors before the podcast began. He was Rock. I was Scissors. And so Evan will have the first pick. We will get to that information in the transfer draft in a little while. We'll talk about Marcus Washington. We'll talk about Stephon Wynn, who was committed to Nebraska on Sunday night. Washington will be here this weekend. Wynn may be here right now. We'll hit the high school recruiting stuff, which is going to be huge, next week. But we'll hit all the transfer stuff. This is kind of their team. I mean, this is kind of the team that they're going to have for 2022. And I think you can make the argument that so as go the transfers, so go the Huskers. That these 15 players are deployed into such crucial spots within the program that their success is going to be a big piece of Nebraska's success. With the exception maybe the offensive line, where the two transfers there may not end up starting for the Huskers. We'll also talk a little bit of basketball. Bryce McGowan's at the NBA Combine. Lat Mayen has left the program. He's going to sign a pro contract in Australia. That was expected for some time. So that happened. And then we're still waiting on Trey McGowan's. What is Trey McGowan's going to do? Is he going to play at Nebraska? Is he going to go to the NBA? He's not currently in school. He was with his brother Bryce at the combine, and so we'll talk a little bit with Jimmy about that, and then we'll be out. But we're going to start with Nebraska baseball. The season is already over. We don't have to talk about Nebraska baseball, Evan, for many, many, many months, most likely. So this will be the last time we talk about them for a while. It was a faceplant of a season. I don't want to sugarcoat it. They were 23 and 30. That's the worst record since 1975. Is that right?
Yeah,
the worst record since 1975. Granted, they're not playing Peru State, UNK, and some of the John Sanders specials from the 90s. But this was a bad team in a bad league. At most, you're going to see three Big Ten teams get into the NCAA tournament. Maryland, who is actually quite good. Rutgers, who's probably going to make it as a three, and then potentially a third team if that team wins the Big Ten tournament, which starts Wednesday. And you were over there talking to those folks today over the Big Ten coaches. But Nebraska finished ninth, or did they finish 10th? I can't remember. They finished ninth.
Ninth, yeah.
In a league that was only going to get three bids. This is not a good league. This is Big 12 North circa, I don't know, 2005. And Nebraska wasn't very good, or 2004, and Nebraska wasn't any good back then in football, so we need to call it what it is. It's Bill Callahan 04, you know, going 5-6 in the Big 12 North that year. This is kind of like that. I mean, this was a terrible season for Nebraska. They were picked to win the Big Ten by the coaches and the media.
Yes.
And they were a preseason top 25 team, and they finished 23-30, and it was nothing short of not good. We can talk a lot about football and why that happened. We know why it happened. Basketball, there's so many situations with basketball and so many issues that they had coming into the year and they've had for several years that I'm more inclined than maybe some other people to give Fred Hoiberg a little bit more time. Obviously, Bolt's not going anywhere. He's done a great job at Nebraska winning a Big Ten title last year, but this was a Big Ten title winning team last year, and they don't even make the tournament this year. What the hell happened?
How much time do we have? No, it was a mess from the start. And, you know, I'll say I put together a preseason Big Ten rankings also. I did not pick Nebraska to win. In fact, I can't remember anybody else locally or nationally that didn't. And that's not because, you know, of whatever. For one, I thought Maryland was that good. But Nebraska, I mean, to have picked them to win the title this year, you had to take a lot of leaps of faith. You had to believe that that next wave of players behind these seniors who were critical parts of that team were ready to take the jump and to be major contributors. And that just wasn't the case this year. It manifested in all sorts of ways, Sam. I mean, some of those showed up in statistics, some of them didn't. It wasn't a very good defensive team, and you know, sometimes that came out in errors, sometimes that just was misplays in the field, just little stuff that sort of stacked up over and over again. I think just in the intangible kind of cultural side of it was interesting, because last year's team had such strong competitive leaders, and it felt like this year they really kind of dragged their feet on figuring out who that was going to be. And it was like, well, this guy's going to be a starter in the rotation, so he should probably be a guy, and this guy's going to be one of our better hitters, so maybe he should be a captain too. And it just, they never had that killer instinct, that sort of daily grind mentality that last year's team was so good at. So that part didn't manifest. The offense was awful, historically awful. I mean, they hit right around 250 for the year, which was, again, you got to go back to the 70s to see a Nebraska team that's hit that poorly. And that's happened in a climate, by the way, in the Big Ten, where scoring was way up this year. I mean, a lot of pitchers were drafted last year. You had all these new rotations, underdeveloped players because of the league-only season, and Nebraska just could not score runs. You know, forget about clutch hits. They couldn't get productive outs. You know, first and third with one out, it'd be a pop-up or it'd be a strikeout. And so, you know, you kind of roll all those things together, and it was a team that just never figured it out. They won two Big Ten series all season. Again, and a down year for the league.
Michigan State and Ohio State.
Michigan State and Ohio State. And otherwise, they couldn't finish series. There were close games. There were blowouts. They were not discriminate as to how they lost games. They lost them in all manners. You've talked about it before. They played a lot of close games, which is indicative of, you know, a team that's certainly not dominant, and they weren't able to finish a lot of those either.
Who's the fourth seed in the Big Ten tournament?
Illinois.
So Nebraska went, if I'm not mistaken, 2-7 against the top four teams in the league. Is that right?
They
didn't play Maryland.
Swept by Rutgers, didn't play Maryland.
1-2 against Iowa, yeah, against Illinois. Mm-hmm. And then if you throw Michigan in there, they were the fifth team. They went 3-9 mm-hmm. against the top five teams in the league. The reason I bring that up is I kind of put it in my Monday rewind that for whatever you want to say about Nebraska football, you know, Nebraska football played seven 9-win teams in the Big Ten. Lost to them all, but they played them. In a lot of ways, Nebraska baseball did not really have that much exposure to the most elite teams in the league. And in many cases, they had them at home. They had a favorable schedule, and it just didn't break their way, you know. And then, of course, they go up and lose the two to Minnesota. If they win two out of three at Minnesota, they're in.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Minnesota's horrible. Horrible team. And they weren't able to do it. So you love baseball at all levels, and I think you follow it a lot more closely than most, certainly more closely than me. I have people in my life who love the game and know the game really well. And so is there a relationship between when you get great pitching, it's like I want to use the right word here, it frees up the hitters and it makes them better. Like Nebraska had great pitching last year, you know? I mean, elite pitching. They had a true Friday night starter in Cade Povich. They had a weird Saturday starter who gave people a hard time in Chance Roach, and they had an elite relief group that was, you know, on the back end with Spencer Schwellenbach. Did that free up the offense to just play better because they knew that they weren't going to have to, you know. The pitching wasn't bad this year.
No.
You've talked about that. It was decent, and they attacked the strike zone. They didn't give a bunch of walks. They didn't chicken crap their way out of stuff. Like, they tried, and they competed, but they weren't great. Does great pitching do something for an offense? In other words, were the offensive weaknesses kind of here, but great pitching helped to kind of paper over those things? And once they didn't have great pitching, that sort of mindset kind of fell apart because they needed more from the offense and the offense wasn't able to deliver?
Well, I think it was just kind of a culmination of two things happening at once where they lose that elite pitching. Like, if you would take the 2021 offense and put it on this team, this 2022 team, with the pitchers that they had this last year, I still think the offense would do pretty well because they had a lot of talented veteran guys. And that bore out in the Big Ten this year. I mean, Maryland is a veteran team. Rutgers is a veteran team. And those, and that's why those teams were so dominant offensively. I think sometimes there's, you know, we talk about it in football a lot where you want to get ahead because then you can kind of open things up a little bit. I think that's true in baseball, and certainly it's true for how Nebraska wants to play baseball too, where they want to take some chances on the base paths. They want hit and runs. They want stolen bases. They want to, you know, lay down a bunt, not necessarily to sacrifice, but to put pressure on the defense. And when you fall behind because you're getting hit, like you're just going to be less apt to take those risks. And I think we saw that a lot. I mean, Nebraska's stolen bases were down. So some of it was personnel. They just didn't have the speedsters to do it. But I think they're all sort of intertwined, right? Like, if your pitching's not as good, then your hitters know that, like, there's pressure on them to hit. And I heard about that a lot last year. A lot of the hitters said that. Like, they felt pressure. First and third with one out, that should be that moment where the pitcher is feeling the pressure. But in a lot of cases, that was Nebraska hitters feeling it because they knew we haven't come through in this situation very much. And, oh, man, if I strike out here we go again. And so I think that really sort of added up. I thought Max Anderson had an interesting thought midway through the year where he used the term hero ball, which you hear a lot for basketball, right, where you want to kind of create your own shot and do your own thing. He felt like there was some of that on the baseball team too, where instead of identifying their roles and sticking to that, whether that's get on base, whether that's, you know, put pressure with your legs, whatever, like all the guys were trying to do too much and be kind of heroes about it. And that sort of, that manifests when your defense is shaky, and that manifests when your pitchers are going to get hit. And so I think some of that, it all sort of bleeds into each other. And so a lot of these confluence of circumstances sort of hit Nebraska at the wrong time.
Yeah, when you have first and third with one out, the goal there is to score the one run.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand the whole, you know, three-run homer, Earl Weaver thing. I get it. And those are great. You know, it's just terrific to be able to do that. Usually those happen first and second, no out. But you got first and third, one out. The goal is to get the one in. And you do that however you got to do it. Which means if you've got to kind of slap at a ball, put it into the right side or put it out in the outfield, fly it out and take the out, like you're talking with productive outs. And they really struggled with that. And I just wonder if it was like one run's not enough. Like, we're down four, we need four, or, you know, well, it's early and we can get this one, but we know we're not going to hold that. So we need to try to get big innings. Somewhere in there, it felt like there was some sort of, like you were saying, hero ball or mindset where Nebraska's still trying to score three when, and you know this well, baseball's going to tell you got to get the one. You just got to get the one, and you have to. Like, it's worse to get zero than it – this won't make – maybe this, maybe you disagree with this. It's worse to get zero than it's great to get three, mindset-wise. Like, if you have first and third and one out – and you don't get anything, and then maybe that happens again, it's not good. Like, that takes a toll on a team's psyche more than the positive hit off of, well, we got three that time. Because baseball is so mental and so situational that, like, part of how a baseball team builds its confidence and its belief in itself is the execution of situations. Mm. And it felt like they were not good at executing situations. And when a baseball team is not good at that, they're honestly not that good. Because very rarely can a team just bash it the way LSU did 25 years ago. Teams are just not that talented anymore, and the pitchers are too good for you to just hammer it all over the yard the way they used to.
What's interesting to me is it seemed like the offense made sort of a philosophical shift this year. So
you talked about it before the season.
So you look back, set it up a few years ago, when Darren Erstad was here, his first like 5 or 6 years here, he had a major league approach to the offense, which was play for the beginning. If you have, you know, if you score three or more runs in an inning, the odds of you winning the game are really high. Mm-hmm. And he shifted late in his tenure at Nebraska into more of a bunt him over, bunt him in, or, you know, bring him in sort of offense. And his reasoning for that was he sort of came to the realization, he's told me this, he came to the realization that college baseball is different than the pros. You know, you're not,
we've talked about,
you're not hitting
it
to major league infielders, you're hitting it to college infielders. And so, and Will Bolt would have said this for 2021 as well, where just because you're laying down a bunt doesn't mean you're necessarily giving up an out. They see that as you're putting pressure on the defense to make a play. And on so often you see those throws go into, you know, right field, down the line, whatever it might be. And so I was a little bit, I thought it was noteworthy this spring when Will Bolt said they felt like they had so much depth in their lineup that they were going to go away from some of that and just let them swing away. And so, you know, maybe that was them trying to adjust to their personnel, but I also felt like it got away from what was so successful with last year's offense too. So it'll be interesting moving forward to see how much they want to bring back the sacrifice bunt, and they did still sacrifice a decent amount, but I think they pulled back on what made them so successful as a unit in 2021, and you know, we'll just see kind of how that looks moving forward. But it was a shift for sure.
Yeah, and you know, like, part of what analytics will do is analytics will give you a really, really good sense of like big picture dynamics. Like, analytics will tell you that in football, that the team that has more explosive plays wins the game. Like, explosive plays is an informant, an indicator of how well, you know, your performance. Unless you suck at the situations, unless you suck at red zone and you suck at third and one, guess what? Here's the trick. Teams that tend to have a lot of explosive plays also tend to be good at situations. And do you know why? Why, Evan?
They have the talent
because they're good teams.
Yeah,
and so what begins this takeaway, this standout thing that people kind of pluck away, it's not that it's wrong. There is a correlation between Alabama producing all of these explosive plays and Clemson producing all these explosive plays and also being good, but it's just corollary. In many ways, the things that piss off coaches the most, the things that they harp on most in practice, are the things that the players want to execute the best because it creates a sense of security in the coaches who coached it. Which is why not being able to run inside zone is a big deal for coaches, because it's like, we can't even run a stinking inside zone. We got to get a quarterback involved and motion and all this other stuff just to gain seven. We can't just hand it off to a back, put him behind our five linemen and plow.
Yeah.
And in baseball, I think there's a sense of, if you can't do the things that baseball players and coaches have done for generations, and Nebraska struggled at those things, it eats away at the confidence of a team. That's the antithesis of Moneyball. We know that. Anybody who's ever read the book knows that Billy Beane got, you know, there was all this hang up on speed and all these other things, and I get it. And fundamentally, I'm a Moneyball kind of person. But there's a secondary level of analytics that comes into play where you have to start to remove for X, Y, and Z, and you have to start to look at, okay, so now that we've taken the numbers and now we've got to look at the sort of colloquial, like, setup things that you do, and are we good there too? And from my perspective, watching Nebraska on TV, because I didn't get to many games this year, as a fan, just sitting in the stands, I just didn't. The little things were the things that were missing. And when you talk to Scott Frost about what is it? It's the little things.
Mm-hmm.
And what is that? The little things are not, we can't, Nebraska's created more explosive plays. They created them by the bushel last year. They get down to the seven and they couldn't score because they didn't have a field goal kicker who could make a 27-yard field goal.
Right.
And every single time a guy misses a 27-yard field goal in football, it's like a stab to the heart of the team. They're like, so we got all the way down there and we did all that work and we bring this guy out here and all he's here to do is that, and he can't do it. It's like the collective temperature on the team just goes whoo.
Mm-hmm.
And in baseball, I think that's part of what happened in Nebraska. They would get in these situations, There's a reason why Bryce Matthews in the second to last game, you know, is like flipping out over doing that, you know, having a home run and all that. It was him, right? Or was it?
Yeah,
Max
it was
Anderson?
Him. Yep.
Because they executed. They actually like got it done. There's still a sense of accomplishment and pleasure in getting it done in the miniature, even if you don't get it done in the maximum. And I think Nebraska just wasn't good enough in doing the miniature stuff.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. And
so what does it look like now? Okay, so like what is it, where do they go now? Like how many players of junior college players have they signed? It appears that the program's going to go through basically an overhaul in the offseason. Lots of guys are probably going to leave, and they're adding a bunch of guys, almost to say is like, well, you guys didn't get it done, so we're going to bring in these guys. Is that accurate?
It is. We talk about roster management in football, and it's, of course, it's insane there. It's less so in baseball, but it's still pretty complicated, especially when you factor in the COVID year. So they've got 9 junior college players right now ready to roll, 7 high school players, and so... sort
say
of
that again. 9 and 7.
So the first step is going to be over this next month, which seniors decide to leave, and some of that will be informed by the draft and whether any have a chance to go to pro ball. But Dawson McCarville, who ended up being a midweek starter, a transfer from Grand Canyon, he's the only player who's out of eligibility, so you know he's gone. Everybody else on that senior class could go a number of ways. Shea Shaneman could come back. Cody Frank, another weekend starter, could come back. Griffin Everett, who was the catcher all year, one of their best hitters, could stay or could go.
They kind of need him to come back, don't they?
They like some of their young guys, like Josh Caron, but yeah, it'd be nice if he could.
From the pitching perspective.
From the pitching perspective, it would be nice to have those weekend guys back. Jake Buns and Kyle Perry, who were supposed to be two of their best pitchers this year and were hurt most of the season. We'll see what that looks like for them.
Perry could be out for a whole nother year, right?
I would think he'd be back at some point next year. He had Tommy John surgery. It's his second one. Sometimes they recover actually quicker from those surgeries the second time around.
Okay.
So you've got the senior decisions. You've got any potential draft departures, probably as unsigned free agents in this particular class.
No draftees?
I don't think so. I mean, it's only a 20-round draft this year. That's still shortened from what it used to be at 40. And you saw, you know, multiple guys at Nebraska have gone as undrafted players recently. Aaron Polinsky was undrafted and has had some success. Jackson Hallmark last year went undrafted and has had some success. So you might see a guy or two go. But then it's going to be a reset with that roster. You're going to see a lot of it. It's not the transfer portal for football, but you start looking at some of these junior college players, you see a lot of pitchers, and you see a lot of outfielders specifically who they feel like they need to come in and compete for jobs right away. So it's going to be a much different looking team.
And to be clear, junior colleges in baseball are very different from junior colleges in football. In football, junior college, I'd say 90% of the athletes who go to junior college are there because they could qualify. Not all of them. Will Honus was an exception. Aaron Rodgers was an exception. Most guys that go to JUCO are there because they couldn't go to the school they wanted to go to because they couldn't get in. In baseball, it's not that. There are a lot of guys that go to junior college because the scholarship numbers at a lot of these schools don't. Now that may change, but they don't really pan out. And so part of what happens is you know you're going to go to a JUCO and you're probably going to matriculate to a pretty good school. Cade Povich is an example. Mm-hmm. I think Cade probably could have gone to a few places out of Bell West, but I think you go to JUCO, you prove it, and then you're going to be in a good spot going into college. So people would look at 9 junior college football signees, and they'd be like, baseball, it's different, right?
It is.
A lot of these guys are going to come in and play right away. The junior college baseball is not that far below what's going on at the non-SAC level.
No, Nebraska's had some good luck with it over the years.
They have.
Tanner Lubach was one a few years
Povich
ago.
Povich is
the example. Yeah. Jake Buns was a JUCO guy. Cam Wynn, I believe, also, who was drafted last year. And Will Bolt and his staff have a history of finding those guys, especially in the, you know, the Kansas area and in the Midwest. You know, Cody Frank was a junior college guy, too. So, yes, it's a method of recruiting. It's just different. And those guys will come in and have a chance to play right away. Freshmen, in freshman baseball players, you see them contribute too, but like I think the rate, if you were to find like the high end junior college baseball players that go to a D1 program, there's got to be a very high hit rate there of guys that end up contributing, as opposed to saying a highly rated freshman who comes in, you don't always know what you're going to get. Drew Christo is an example of that.
Is something wrong there, or is that going to get turned around?
He just, you know, he had the one pitch this year. Command was elusive at times. He was healthy, as far as I'm aware, and they just felt like he needed more time to acclimate. So he was a top 100 recruit.
Yeah,
we'll see how that goes. But I mean, that certainly played a part in things too.
And that the challenge here is they got to the point where they started playing fewer and fewer non-conference games because they were getting toward the end of the year and they had finals and all that. B, they had no margin for error. And when you eliminate a margin for error, you can't go throw a guy out there midweek and find out. You can't do it more than once. So I think that was part of the challenge too, is like, you know, I think a lot of eggs were put in the, we need to make the Big Ten tournament basket. You wrote about it, I think, 4 weeks before the end of the season. And rightfully so, Evan, rightfully so. But I think what you wrote was in part a reflection of what the team was thinking about, yes? Like, we're not in the top eight teams, and we need to find a way to do it. And to be honest with you, outside of the final weekend, which I guess they won 2 out of 3, they managed to fritter away the one game against Minnesota, the disastrous rain-delayed game against Illinois that they never should have blown, and then, you know, the game against Indiana. It felt like pressure kind of got to them late.
It did, and they had... They had so much help along the way. I mean, Indiana got swept on the last weekend. All the teams in the bottom 4 or 5, and you wrote about that too, about the logjam between 5th and 12th in the league played out. I mean, all those teams, Nebraska had every chance to pass most of those teams, and they didn't do it. And so, you know, the conversation I thought last weekend about the whole Purdue cancellation thing was humorous in the sense that, like, How did it come down to this? How did it come down to Nebraska having to worry about the weather 600 miles to the east and to worry about the curfew policy for Maryland on a Saturday night? Yeah. Like, it never should have come down to that. And I mean, again, like putting it all together, you have to put it all in context, right? Because like we said, they were preseason favorites. They were a top 25 preseason team. Mm-hmm. And this is what they were reduced to at the end. So certainly a humbling but fitting end of their year.
Last question, and then we'll get on to transfers as Jimmy Watkins joins us. Okay, so what's the calendar here? A lot of guys scatter. Anybody going to the East Coast League? What do they call it?
Cape Cod?
Yeah, anybody going to Cape Cod?
Max Anderson, yeah. For sure.
Usually that's where your best prospects go.
Yep. So he'll be there. It'll be a lot of summer ball. A lot of Huskers usually end up in the Northwoods League.
Northwoods League, which is Wisconsin and Iowa and Minnesota.
So your top players go to like the Cape and some of those places to face the best competition. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, Nebraska puts an emphasis on where can you get the most at bats or the most innings. And Northwoods tends to have been that place for them.
Is that a wood bat league?
Yes. Okay. It is.
So they're Cape Cod is a wood bat league.
Believe so. Yes. Okay.
Now, the transfer rules in baseball, they're going to lose some players. Some players are just going to leave.
Some. They have not lost many.
Not the MLB draft. They might get a guy that decides to leave because of that. But yeah. I'm talking young players here.
Yeah, maybe. There hasn't been all that much movement in the roster in the portal era for the baseball team. But yeah, they might lose a couple.
Yeah.
You've got the draft in mid-July. You might find someone out of the portal or two. I think a lot of your biggest Big Ten success stories have come about because teams found players out of the portal.
Yeah.
Whether that's other D1s, D2, D3, even some NAIA. So we'll see what Nebraska does there too. But so that's kind of how it's going to go. And then they'll report back in August.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting thing to watch. Just what the roster looks like, how it's different. I think you would agree that the Big Ten's not going to get dramatically better next year. Maybe it will. Maybe
I agree with that.
Some young teams, but it's just not generally a power league. Hard to say if Nebraska would have been better in the Big 12, because sometimes the competition can make you step up your level. And I do think that the name across the front of that jersey, when it's Rutgers, you're like, well, we'll beat Rutgers at least once, and then you don't beat them at all. And then you see that name and you look at the record of Minnesota and, well, we'll beat them at least twice, and then you only beat them once, that kind of stuff. Yeah, so
they didn't beat TCU either. So
that's true. That's true. I guess we'll never know. All right, moving on to transfers. So Nebraska received two transfers, and it may be their final two transfers. In fact, I expect it to be their final two transfers. Stephon Wynn on Sunday night, which we kind of largely expected to happen. I can talk about him in a minute and how they can kind of work that defensive front. And then the other one was Marcus Washington, who committed today. That had been rumored to happen for a couple of days, but he committed today. 6'2", 190-pound receiver out of Texas. Originally went to Trinity Catholic High School in St. Louis. That is now closed, by the way. And he was part of a Lindenwood University camp that they had in 2017 with Coach Mike Riley. Isaiah Williams, who's now the top receiver at Illinois, was there. Shaman Cooper was there as a linebacker. He's also at Illinois. A tight end who happened to be there and did not come to Nebraska is the top tight end at Iowa right now. He was a family friend of Tanner Farmer, and Nebraska did not recruit him.
Ouch.
They could have had them both.
Wow.
There was a bunch of different guys there who were pretty good players. That guy might have been the best player of the bunch. He's going to end up being Sam Laporta, I'm talking about.
Yeah.
He'll end up being a second-day draft pick. But anyway, Nebraska worked a lot of those guys out. Marcus Washington went to Texas, and now he is at Nebraska. And, Jimmy, you talked to his father today about his story. Why did Marcus Washington pick Nebraska?
Well, speaking of family friends, Marcus Washington's father, Nunu, grew up one door down from the cousin of Nebraska director of high school relations, Kenny Wilhite.
Hmm.
They played high school football about 18 miles apart. They grew up together. They spent summers together. And throughout this process, Marcus's dad is very concerned about what Marcus's life is going to look like after football. He thinks he encourages his son to chase NFL dreams, but he also he was impressed by the things that were not about football, which is what he said with the conversations that he had with Wilhite. And that's things like the kind of Nebraska has a setup where they're very hands-on. They offer a lot of resources for student athletes after they graduate, that sort of thing. But I think, part of it, too, is that Casey Thompson and Marcus Washington played together at Texas. Those guys have pretty good chemistry. Marcus saw an elevated role at Texas last year while Casey was the starter. He caught some passes from Hudson Card, too, but mostly played with Casey. His dad has been talking to Mark Whipple a lot. He's been impressed by Whipple. He thinks Mark Whipple's offense, he likes the pro style. He thinks that'll better prepare his son to play in the NFL. He also likes that Lincoln is smaller than Texas, or smaller than Austin, because he thinks that it will help his son focus on just football, which is obviously what we're talking about here.
But are you saying Austin is a more interesting town than Lincoln?
I didn't say it. That's what Nunu Washington said.
That's a common refrain from parents of football
players. That's what Nunu Washington said. I didn't say it. That's just what the parents said. So, yeah, I think it's this is more of a life call, I guess, than it is a football call. Of course, it's a football call because you're making the decision where you're going to play football. But it's a bigger picture. Marcus's dad was a good football player in high school and then sort of steered down the wrong road, ended up in jail for a little bit, and he's determined for his son to carve out something better for him. That's a story I just wrote while you guys were talking about baseball. So I think that's why, if there's one big reason why Marcus Washington is here or going to be here.
Speaking of baseball,
they just, as we're talking about people leaving, Leighton Vanjoff, who was their left fielder for a lot of the year, decides he's going to transfer. So, live as it happens, he's moving on.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a couple of those. When you have a year like that, I think, don't you inevitably think, okay, things are going to change? I mean, they didn't bring all those junior college guys in to, sit the bench and, and eat hot dogs. So. Marcus Washington is an interesting player. In some ways, he's the logical replacement for Xavier Betts. Betts is probably not coming back, or if he does at some point, that'll have to be, a moderated or mediated process because I don't think there's a scholarship available for him. Washington's game is somewhat similar. Long striding receiver, good 50-50 ball downfield, kind of a deep ball guy, fluid, player. Probably not quite as fast or as dynamic as Betts, but had his moment. And obviously has a relationship with Casey Thompson. Anytime you can go play with a quarterback who knows you and has thrown the football to you quite a bit, I think that's encouraging. And so he probably becomes one of their X receivers, right? You know, in this particular offense, I think that you know, Whipple is going to move guys around. They're going to learn multiple positions. They're going to be all over. But I think it's fair to say that Trey Palmer will probably be very close to the number one option. Omar Manning will be, you know, up there too. Garcia Castaneda, we'll see. Got to figure out a way to use Oliver Martin mm-hmm. in a way where he actually gets the football.
Alante Brown.
I think I feel pretty good about where Alante Brown is going to play on the field. He needs to maneuver in the middle of the field, I'd say, most part. But Washington's probably a guy that you stick outside, and you know, he's one of your outside receivers. Valuable in the red zone. Guy that can hit deep routes between the numbers and the sideline. You know, and then you can also probably bring him over the middle and get him to catch something over the top of a corner, get inside of a corner, get over the top of a safety, those kind of things. I wouldn't describe him as an NFL draft pick at this point, but I wouldn't have described Samari Toure that way either. And Toure was drafted. So it's an interesting pickup for Nebraska. The other one that they got was Stephon Wynn, 6'4", 307-pounder from Alabama, played four seasons there, was effectively just behind players who are really good. And early in his career, he was behind some guys that are already in the NFL. This most recent year, he's basically behind three seniors. I wouldn't describe any of those guys as like first-round picks at this moment, but they're all pretty good players. And he's kind of the fourth guy. And he probably wasn't going to play a ton there. He would have played some. I think it would have been in a rotation. Alabama does tend to run kind of a 3-4, but they also kind of run that, you know, whatever you call what Nebraska does, that 2-4-5, that 4-2-5, whatever you want to call it. And so Wynn probably wasn't going to get a ton of time on the playing field. And Alabama has very dynamic players either right outside the tackles or behind them. So their inside linebackers are good. Their outside linebacker, obviously Will Anderson being one of them, are good. And so a lot of the featured players within that defense were those particular guys. So Wynn comes here. He's going to probably have 2 years. He was a 2018 enrollee at Alabama. Obviously, the 2020 year doesn't count because of COVID. So he's probably got 2 years left, and I think could be a really nice player. They've basically reset themselves on the defensive line. If you're going to say Fildarius Payne, Jordan Riley, Casey Rogers, I think the three that they've got, Mathis, Devin Drew, and Wynn, have greater potential than the three they lost. Now we'll see if that potential becomes a thing. But I think that they probably got a little bit better in terms of their talent. I think all three, you know, Drew's a three-star, Wynn's a four-star, Mathis is a four-star. You know, and Jordan Riley was a four-star, but he didn't play a lot of football at the major college level. He didn't. He's been hurt a lot. Rogers was a hard, kind of a ham and egg three-star guy that bulked up and worked really hard, and I wish Nebraska still had him. And then Payne was a guy that probably needed to play, and I don't know what he'll do at Virginia Tech. I assume he'll be an outside backer. He's a little heavy for that. He's a guy that probably needs to be an undersized defensive tackle, and he wasn't. That's what he was in JUCO. He's not quite fast enough at this level, and O'Shawn Mathis, a little leaner, a little taller, is. That creates a scenario now where Nebraska has 15 transfers. And, Jimmy, what you did not know is that we are going to do a transfer draft.
I'm ready.
Each one of us get five, and we are going to carry this through the season. We're doing this draft now. And if they add a 16th player, I guess that will go for a player to soon be determined. But we did paper, rock, scissors before the podcast. Evan won, so he goes first. I go second. Because you weren't here, you go third.
Fair.
And then it's a snake draft, so you get third and fourth,
okay.
So on and so forth. So we're going to do a transfer draft. Evan, you get the first pick. A lot of pressure here. A lot of ways you could go.
With this year in mind?
Well.
I mean, that's what Nebraska's thinking.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, you know, there's some considerations to be made for out years,
guys. Yeah.
Especially with some of these younger guys. But yeah. We can carry this out for a couple of years. But we'll definitely revisit
we'll
revisit it, you know, during the season a couple different times. You have the very first pick.
I mean, yeah, I got to go with Casey Thompson, the likely quarterback starter, the first quarterback other than Adrian Martinez to hitch his cart to Scott Frost's horse, or however you want to say it. So, starts with that, man. New quarterback. How is he different from Adrian? How different does the offense look? Give me Casey Thompson.
I'll take O'Shawn Mathis, the outside linebacker, pass rusher, who's here for probably one, but maybe 2 years. Just a dynamic player, I think, can come off the edge and can create some problems for opposing defenses that will also free, or opposing offenses that will also free up interior pass rushers. So I'll take O'Shawn Mathis. You get third and fourth picks, Jimmy.
I'll take Trey Palmer, and I will take Tommy Hill for similar reasons. Okay. Both guys that we expect to be immediate impact players. I think we think Tommy Hill's going to get that second corner's job. We just talked about Trey Palmer being the number one option. But I also like, particularly at these positions, I like flair. I like swagger.
Mm-hmm.
I like,
both have it.
Yes. I like talk. I like trash talk. I've talked to both of these players about trash talking to each other, and they're both very – they both get animated when you ask them those questions. Both got the athletic traits that you're looking for out of that position. And both, I mean, in Trey's case, comes with some really high pedigree, five-star kid from LSU originally, knows the position coach. That's huge. And because of that relationship, I think can set a tone in that room, whereas most transfers don't get the chance to do that. And I think Tommy Hill, Nebraska wants Quentin Newsom to be big, loud, vocal guy this year. He's the top corner. They want him to assume that role. But that takes some adjusting, too. And I think that when you have someone like Tommy Hill, who I've never seen him in a locker room or out of practice, but it just seems like he takes more naturally to that setting. I think maybe he might, at the very least, help Newsom along in that regard, if not share some of that responsibility with him.
It's my turn.
A few ways you could go here, yeah.
I'll take Devin Drew. Snap-heavy guy that can do a lot of different things for Nebraska and you know, I think can hold up in there and a savvy guy. If you get 25, 30 tackles out of him, he can be extremely valuable. Evan, you have the next two picks.
I'm going to go Timmy Bleakrode, especially if Nebraska is going to continue to play these close games. As you've said, if you have a kicker that can make those 27-yarders and makes your decisions easier, adjust your play calling, I mean, that guy can impact things a lot of ways if he's close to automatic, especially from the 40 in. And I'm going to go, this is maybe more of a long-term pick, but I'm going to go Chuba Purdy. I think, you know, whether he gets significant snaps this year because of injury, how interesting he makes things in fall camp and moving forward, I think he really impressed in the spring game and the limited chances that he got. So we'll see what his impact is this year, but I like him certainly long-term too.
All right. I'm going to go with a receiver too. I'm going to go with Isaiah Garcia Castaneda, based on the things that I've heard about him and what he might be able to bring to the table. Bigger physically than I thought he would be. He's a fairly physically sized guy. He's probably 6 foot, but he's not 170 pounds. He's a bigger guy, and he does actually remind me a little bit of Samari Toure, but only a little thicker. I think he's going to have a nice season. I think they like what he can bring to the table. My third pick is Isaiah Garcia Castaneda.
I'm taking the new guys. Taking Marcus Washington and Stephon Wynn. Again, two guys that are going to play, which is, I think, great value at this point in the draft. Marcus Washington, we talk about, I mean, a guy who could replace Xavier Betts. I know that's more of like a body type, player type comparison, but Nebraska had big plans for Xavier Betts this year.
Did.
So if there's any more similarities to their game beyond the body type and the speed, then we could be talking about something here. And of course, the chemistry that he has with the quarterback already is a huge advantage for him that none of these other receivers have. I mean, they've got to play spring ball with Casey, but Marcus Washington got to do a whole lot more than that. Stephon Wynn, same thing. He's playing at a position that has been spotlighted for most of the offseason, be it via transfers or coaching changes or the leader of that position group advocating for more players being brought in at that position. So we heard in the spring that the offensive line was pushing the defensive line around a little bit. I think Stephon Wynn is part of the solution to that problem.
Brian Buscini is my pick. The punter, the FCS punter from Montana, had a hot and cold spring game. It's my feeling that a punter is more valuable than a kicker at the collegiate level because of field position and because what I've watched is at the collegiate level, there aren't that many elite kickers. And you rarely run across them. I don't remember in the last several years running across an Alex Henry in the Big Ten. And there might have been, but I can't remember who it is, or Justin Tucker or whatever. Punters, on the other hand, there's a lot of really, really, really good ones. Even if they make it in the NFL or not, they're elite. And I think Buscini has the chance to at least bring Nebraska a little closer in the punts race. I don't know that he's the best in the league. In fact, I would say if he's in the top half, we'd be doing well. But Nebraska has not had a top half punter in some time. And I'm very comfortable saying that last year they had the worst punting operation in the Big Ten. I don't know if of college football. So Brian Buscini is my fourth pick. Evan, you have two more back to back.
The punts race. I like that.
Yeah.
I'm going to go Williams and Williams. And Kevin Williams, I will say first. He's a strong character guy. Just talking with him, he's a guy who has kind of the personality that you want in a lineman.
I saw him today. He has a really cute dog.
That doesn't help my point, but we'll go with that. Yeah,
it's worth something.
He seems versatile. I mean, that he's lined up at
doesn't help your point.
Well, it's like the tough lineman who has the cute dog, but whether
a man,
sure. But he's lined up at tackle. He's been at guard. It seems like he's got the versatility too. And then Kane Williams, who to me signals that Nebraska still is looking for a little something in the secondary. And you don't get that guy if you feel good about your top six guys, right? You probably go a different direction. So the fact that they bring him in that climate, as a chance to contribute early. He's gone through an SEC season before, has a little bit of seasoning in that regard. Give me Kane Williams too.
Betting big on the long-term guys, Evan. Purdy and Williams.
Playing the long game. Keeper
that
league.
Me.
I only have two left. There's only two left, and I go first.
Okay.
So it's Hunter Anthony or Omar Brown.
Okay.
I'll take Hunter Anthony.
Okay.
Because you took Marcus Washington already.
I did, yes. Yeah.
I'll take Hunter Anthony, the Oklahoma State transfer. I know I had Omar Brown high on my list prior to the spring, but I think there's injury issues there and just some things to work through. Hunter Anthony will be my final pick. Interesting player. I think could play at Nebraska. Has a couple of years left. Might be a tackle option. Maybe a perimeter guy. Hunter Anthony will be my fifth pick.
I guess that leaves me with Omar Brown. Mm-hmm. Not to...
You don't know much about Omar.
About Omar Brown, but he does have the words All-American in his bio on Huskers.com. So that's promising. And that, jokes aside, that kind of pedigree is when you, it's one, I think almost more important than stars in terms of immediate impact. Obviously the five-star guys project better, but a guy who has excelled in college football, not at this level, but a guy who has excelled in college football. Maybe he's sort of floated down the depth chart because of injuries for now, but if you need a guy who can step in immediately in case of other injury, I'm leaning towards the guy who has produced at the college level before.
All right. Well, there we go. Did you keep a list of that?
I did, yes.
That's good. That's very good. Leighton Banjoff leaving. Wouldn't that surprise you?
I don't know. I mean, he's one of those guys who had it rough. I mean, there was a COVID year and he had an injury, and so it's been a little rough for him in that regard. But I don't know. I guess a little bit. They liked his bat. He was really good in 2020 before the season got axed. But they're gonna turn this thing over, man. The coaches were they were not happy with how things went. It's gonna look a lot different.
It's gonna be really, really interesting. Okay, we'll get more to the high school recruiting coming forward. I thought we could talk briefly about any of Trev Albert's comments, if any of those jump out at you. The red balloon thing does not move my heart. And let me be clear why. I haven't been a fan of the program. I don't think I've held a red balloon I don't remember getting one as a college student. I don't think I've held a red balloon since I was in elementary school. And so it isn't something that, but my children have held these red balloons and they've let them go. And I know it's a small joy to them. But I don't necessarily have the same investment level. I've taken photos at times of the balloons in the sky after a touchdown, or made a joke that everybody, you know, premature, you know, release of the balloon when a penalty calls a touchdown back. But at the end of the day, when Trev Albert said what he said about the red balloons last night, the thing about the helium is legitimate. It is unbelievably expensive at this moment. About a third. I found this out on Radio France International. Mm. About a third of the world's helium is produced by Russia.
Mm.
They had a new plant go online in the far east of Russia. And, of course, people who know the geography of Russia know that Russia extends all the way beyond every nation in the Pacific Ocean, I think, all the way out to, you know, almost touching Alaska. And so this plant is all the way out there, and it, you know, I think it was helping supply helium for not only, you know, the countries around the Pacific Ocean, such as Japan and China and others, but also partially the United States.
Hmm.
And of course, we're not receiving any imports, I believe, from Russia at this time because of its invasion in Ukraine. So the cost of helium is absurd. According to a Miami Herald story, it is costing $1,800 a liter. They were paying $74.
Whoa.
So if we can appreciate the cost of just making the red balloons each Saturday and the value of that, that's part of the issue. I know people will talk about the environmental impact. I don't want to delve too far into that. I do know there is an environmental impact. We'll have a story about this tomorrow. I know there is one. I do think that's part of the concern, but I really do think that the other part of the concern is helium. The cost of helium is like making the balloons out of gold. Not quite gold, but you know what I mean. Some other precious metal. So it's like blowing gold into the balloon. Anyway, they need the helium for the UNMC MRI scanners and other things. So that's where it is. But did anything else jump out at you about his division? Talks about divisions or
yes.
Talks about whatever?
I had his comments about divisions jumped out to me. But first, I would like to say that you could make a real juicy clickbait headline out of that balloons Russia thing, like something like how the Red Scare impacts the red balloons or something like that. You could do something.
It's not the Red Scare, but I understand what you mean.
You could do something with that. The part about the divisions that jumped out to me with Trev Alberts talking about divisions last night is that a guy whose program it directly disadvantages to have divisions eliminated came out in favor of eliminating divisions. And I'm trying to rack my brain as to why. I think the best thing I can come up with is it could be like a vote of confidence for Nebraska, right? Like, I think if you put Truth Serum into the coaching staff right now, they would all say it's probably not a good thing for Big Ten to eliminate divisions because it decreases their chances of playing for a Big Ten championship. But maybe Trev is trying to play some 3D chess here and inject some confidence by considering that, you know, maybe that's not the case. Nebraska can get up on the level of these Penn States, Michigans, whatever. I just thought that was interesting that he came out in favor of something that would hurt his program's chances of returning to national or even regional relevancy.
Mm. Yeah, well, you know, I think there's a possibility that it would. I mean, obviously, Nebraska hasn't been to the Big Ten championship since they went to East and West. So it's not like they've been real close. The only year in which they were really close was 2014 and 2016. And they weren't that close in 2016. If they'd beaten Wisconsin in 2014, they would have gone to the Big Ten championship and played Ohio State and been beaten very badly by the Buckeyes that year. So, you know, I think there's something to be said for that. I agree that, you know, there's something to be, hey, we won the West. That's something you can, you know, crow about. You'd be getting rid of that crowing. Finishing second doesn't really mean much. They remember in 2012 when they won the Big Ten West, they got the hats.
Sure.
I remember Jeremiah Searles wearing the hat after, maybe Spencer Long too. They're wearing the hat in Kinnick, you know.
The other thing is you go eight.
They don't no more hats. No more division.
No more
hats. You don't get a hat for finishing second in the Big Ten.
They were Big 12 North. There's merch for that too back
That's right.
in the day.
The other thing is like you go 8-4, in with divisions, your ceiling is the Rose Bowl. You go 8-4 without divisions, you're not going to the Big Ten Championship. You're going to maybe the Capital One Bowl or something like that.
That's an interesting way of putting it. That's a good thought. I get that.
Is it unlikely that you will beat Ohio State, Michigan, whoever, as an 8-4 team?
No,
sure, but
you're
60 minutes from glory.
Because what you mean to say is that an 8-4 team, which they have not done,
right, that even
could
that
win
is,
the Big Ten Championship.
Yes.
If you eliminate it, and that 8-4 team will not be the number two team in the league.
The standard for...
They will not be able to play for the Rose Bowl. They'll play for... They'll just... Their season will be over, and they'll go to Orlando.
Yeah.
That's a good point, Jimmy. I hadn't thought of that. It does remove the incentive a little bit. Like once you hit that wall. I'm not sure it'll happen. I'm not sure they're going to get rid of it. You know how... You want to know why? Because they haven't gotten rid of it yet. And there wouldn't have been anything to stop them from getting rid of it.
Well, the media... You don't think... You don't buy Trev's explanation
deal.
About the media rights deal?
I buy it, but... I think about that question for a second. Think about it. What would the media rights deal have to do with scrapping the divisions? I know, but I'm curious if you do.
I don't.
Well, I want to know if Michigan, Ohio State, if the value of that game goes down because they might play again.
Not if you move it, I don't think.
If you move it, it ain't worth the same money.
Really? Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's a
part of the special of Ohio State, Michigan is Saturday noon, 2 days after Thanksgiving. It ain't middle of the season. It's not that. It's not Oklahoma, Texas. Which of the two games is bigger?
It's not close.
That's right. Some of that's because of where that game's at. And I'll tell you why. If you go through the 80s, hell. In the 70s, the Ohio State-Michigan game was bigger. In the 80s, Oklahoma-Texas was bigger. You could argue there were times in the 2000s, from starting in 1999 through 2005, when the biggest football game of the year, 2008, biggest football game of the year was Oklahoma-Texas. It was never as big as Ohio State-Michigan. Part of that is because of where that game's at. If you play the Ohio State-Michigan game the day, 2 days after Thanksgiving, and then those two teams have to play each other again in a week, I mean, it's just no.
What if you play it the first week of November? You can kind of maintain the.
This doesn't. I don't think it changes much. I think the only thing that would change it is if you were able to create a Final Four, where what happens is Ohio State plays Michigan, and then there's like 2 weeks of playoff games, and one plays four, and two plays three. But even then, again, you could have a potential rematch between Ohio State and Michigan. It would be back to back. The other question to ask is, what do they lose? What do they lose by keeping the divisions? What's wrong with it now? From the Big Ten's perspective.
The Big Ten championship game is often a walkover.
Okay. Is that a bad thing?
I think so.
You want a coronation?
If your goal is to have easier access to the college football playoff, then, yeah, you would want your best team to have the clearest path to that point.
Also goes to my point last week about what if they make the conference championship games an automatic qualification.
But they've removed that restriction, right? That's what the NCAA has done. You don't need a conference championship.
I'm talking about for the playoff, like in the future. It could be, if they expand the playoff, that you win your conference. You are in the college football
then
playoff.
Then it becomes a different story. But then, that's the thing. They don't know that, though.
Right. I think that's likely, though.
They don't know that. Well, the Big Ten wants it, Jimmy. Other leagues don't. The other leagues do not want that. Now, it doesn't mean that it wouldn't most likely happen 99% of the time. But they don't want that. The thing that you could argue is if you keep the divisions, then it makes all of the games meaningful in the West. If you scrap the divisions, are you risking an Ohio State, Michigan, Penn State invitational? Are you risking that? You know? And the question is, I don't know.
Could you also increase your chances of getting multiple teams in the playoff by doing that? Because Maybe. Yes. Yeah.
Well, if you went to 12, the Big Ten would get at least two and perhaps three every year. But I don't know. Like, it's a tricky conversation because there's really nothing wrong from the Big Ten's perspective with Ohio State winning the Big Ten title every year or Michigan winning it. Now, who does that hurt? Nobody's bothered by that.
It's good to have a villain.
You know, there's nothing, but nobody's bothered by those two things. And so, like, is Ohio State, Michigan going to be willing to change? Or are they going to be willing to risk that they might play each other twice and play each other back to back? The next question is, and this is, I think, important, name me the greatest conference championship game of all time.
Eh.
Got one?
Name me the great, I don't know, I think it's hard to name the greatest anything of all time, but I think that's could be because there's not a ton of weight placed on them right now.
So why? Why gear anything you do toward that game if it doesn't matter?
You could make it matter more. Part of the reason could be because we're getting all these walkovers in conference championship games.
Sure. My point being that, like, I would say the greatest game ever played in a conference title game was the SEC championship between Georgia and Alabama in 2012, where Aaron Murray is intercepted with 4 seconds left.
The Hurts
and,
game,
you know.
Yeah.
That was a different game.
Yeah.
The Hurts
same
game
teams,
was,
though.
Yeah, it was the same teams. There's been a couple of classics in the SEC. There actually was an incredible Big Ten championship game between Iowa and Michigan State. Went right down to the end, 16-13.
Yeah.
The very first one was very good with Kirk Cousins against Russell Wilson. Of course, Russell Wilson won that game because he's the better quarterback. But generally speaking, what the conference title games have functioned beautifully as is a television property. They are not, and of course the 2009 Big 12 championship game, memorable. They function really well as a television property. That's what they do. They don't necessarily function as a, unless it's in the SEC, a knockout game. And there's been a number of times where the Pac-12 has had a team lined up, Utah a couple of years ago, and they get knocked out because they lose in the title game. And so I think my point is that, like, why create a system that has any, like, that helps you determine who should play in those two games at all? I think that the driving thought process behind it is, well, the reason you get rid of divisions is because, to be quite frank, you're not playing all the teams, you know, over the course of 4 years. Like, Nebraska could go 4 years between playing Penn State. They could go, a whole class of Huskers could come through and never play a game at, well, I don't know that you'd want to, but play a game at Rutgers or at Michigan or at Michigan State or Ohio State. And I think there's a thought process there that, like, what's really a problem is that Nebraska doesn't really need to play Purdue and Northwestern and Illinois every year. They need to play their little pod, build rivalries there, and then treat Purdue just like you do Michigan State. I don't have a burning desire to ever go. No, it's no offense to that place. It's a lovely campus.
You guys drag that every opportunity.
Campus is okay.
Or whatever.
I just have no burning desire to make the 2.5-hour drive down from Midway Airport and sit on the back of a golf cart going to Ross-Ade Stadium ever again.
No, no.
It's a beautiful. The campus is actually quite pretty. It is. It's a nice campus.
Fine. Yeah, it's fine.
But I don't have a burning desire to ever do that again. So, like, I can't imagine the Nebraska coaches are like, now here's one thing we get to do. You know, like, I just. Now, Indiana wants to play Purdue every year, and I'm sure Purdue wants to play, you know, someone. But you know what I mean?
Yes.
Now, I kind of like going to Northwestern. I like going up the train and going to Mustard's Last Stand and getting a dog and then going inside and watching half, you know, kind of a neutral site game and a nice city. That's cool. But, you know, I don't ever have any burning desire to go back to Champaign, Illinois either.
Agreed.
And sit way up top and look at a field that looks like it's been faded by the sun and, you know, walk by that photo of Lou Tepper and, you know, all the coaches that they have, the photos that they have in the lobby of, you know, Ron Zook and Lou Tepper and all the other coaches they've had.
Yes.
I don't have any burning desire to return to that place. I'm guessing Nebraska football fans don't either.
No, I don't think so. I agree. Like, and part of me is like, if you're really going to switch anything up, you wonder if, like, switching up divisions would make sense. Like, why not just reshuffle things? Because when they made the East and the West, it was with the idea that it was somewhat balanced. You know, obviously Ohio State and Michigan were your powers, but like, you know, Wisconsin looked better then than they do now. Nebraska, there's still, I think, more legitimate hope that they would take the bull by the horns than they have. And then Northwestern's won the thing. So I don't know, like, what if you scrap geography for the divisions and you shuffle that up a little bit, put Penn State in one opposite of Ohio State and Michigan, keep those two together to preserve the rivalry and to prevent, you know, a rematch. But like, I agree. Like, I don't, because the Big Ten hasn't rushed to scrap divisions, to me suggests that they still see a good amount of value in it as they protect some of their top games.
Basketball, Jimmy, Latman leaving.
Latman leaving. It was a good run.
Any memories of that? Good guy.
There's the Rutgers game from 2021 where he had 5 threes and scored 25 points, most of which came before halftime. I do think that everyone on that team respected him. I think that he was – he's not the loudest guy, but I think that he was a guy who could, if things were going sideways, call a huddle and, you know, people would listen to what he had to say. And they might bleed 10 more points after that huddle, but that's not necessarily his fault. The story of Latman's Nebraska tenure is Latman's jump shot, which came and went.
And they really needed it to be like a 45% three-point shooter.
It came and went and went and went and went. When he went on droughts, he went on long droughts.
What was his number this year?
29.9%? Like, that's just... You can't have that. And he's out there to be a stretch 40. Four. He's supposed to be a floor spacer. Oh, you can't have that. So... it didn't work out. He made all four of his threes according to the box score in his first Australian professional game. I guess that's my other takeaway from this news, is that no one really knew it was coming.
When it was coming.
Yes, everyone knew that this was going to be the path that he chose, but he didn't tell anyone, it doesn't sound like. Like, Nebraska, I talked to Seamus McKnight, the SID, today, and I don't think he was necessarily, like, I don't think he was had that press release ready to hit send on. I think it was Lat was just moving on with his life and focused on that. He's never been a big social media guy, which I respect. I don't think you have to announce every step that you take in your life. It would have been helpful for me, but that's okay.
I don't know. I mean, he was a good guy. I liked Lat a lot. He wrote a real good story about him.
He's cool. His family's cool.
His life and you know, he's been a few places. Second game of his career, he had a three to tie the game, I think, against Nevada, and he turned it down. And it made no sense because he had a really good first game. It's just, you know, Nebraska's got to get, the way I would put it is, they've got to get one of these transfers that they get to really, really, really be good. And Trey McGowan's was good, but he wasn't. I mean, Trey was hurt, and there was other things going on. They need one of these transfers to be really special.
To pop, yeah.
And, like...
I think Sam Griesel is the guy that would.
You can argue Delano Banton was that. I mean, he got drafted in the NBA, but Delano was hit and miss too. Teddy Allen was hit and miss as well. Like, they have to find a guy that's just consistently good. And CJ Wilcher may be that guy. I thought CJ was extremely dependable over the last half of the season. He did what you wanted him to do, which was make threes.
Yeah, and even showed a little bit more off the dribble shake than he showed at the beginning of the season. I think... You can see the way they're going. They've added three grad transfers. They want you look at the, like, where they're grabbing guys. Sam, North Dakota State, Sam Griesel is a winning program. SMU is a winning program, won 20 games last year. Juwan Gary, the Alabama, is a burgeoning winning program. So this is more of a bet. I was thinking about how to phrase the shift in dynamic the other day when just kind of looking at the roster. I think this team is more likely to, I think the parts themselves, we want to use the sum of the parts analogy, some of the parts themselves should add up to less, but I think these parts added together are more likely to add up more. The sum of these parts are likely to add up to more than what they should than last year's group would.
Can't be any agendas.
Yeah. That's what, I mean, you saw Sam did an interview with a podcast, which the name of which I am forgetting right now, last week, and that's something that Easton, that's what everyone says at this time of year, and there's no selfish guys on this team. I kind of believe it a little bit more this time around. There are, like, you think about, and again, I'm not casting aspersions on any of these guys, but Alonzo Verge had 1 year to prove that he was an NBA guy last year. Bryce McGowan's...
Well, Bryce had an agenda, too.
We're getting there. Yeah. We're getting there. Bryce McGowan's came in thinking he was going to be a one-and-done guy, and this was my NBA mixtape season. So, these guys are less like that. Of course, everyone wants to play in the NBA, but I think that when you have a guy who needs to play 4 years to get to the NBA, it's just different.
I totally agree. And the year before, Teddy wanted to, you know, I mean, and he looks like he's going to have a chance now that he's went to a smaller school and dominated there. But and Banton was actually quite unselfish, so he didn't have an agenda. But I think agendas are the thing they've got to try to get rid of, and they've just got to find a way to. It's got to be all about winning, you know. It's got to be all about winning.
And then you said you need these transfers. I think they need one of the freshmen to pop, like one of the new guys.
Sure.
Ramel Lloyd and Jamarcus Lawrence in particular. I was texting with a coach who thinks that Emmanuel Bandemil has some untapped playmaking potential. But the fact is that dude just has never been a decision maker with the ball in his hands at the Division I level. He's been like a 3-and-D guy. And maybe there is more there. But, even if that's true, I don't think him and Sam are going to be enough in that guard. They need more pop. They need Ramel Lloyd to provide that, or Jamarcus Lawrence, somebody.
I think they could have the best defensive team they've had in some time.
It's very possible. They
weren't great defensively the first 3 years.
Another dynamic shift. Look at who the guards were last year. Look at who the guards were this year. Last year, Kobe Webster, Alonzo Verge, Keisei Tominaga. Keisei's still here, but
healthy.
Yes, right, but he wasn't. What are the commonalities between most of those guys? Short, shifty, jitterbuggy guys, offense first. Sam 6'6". It's not like that. Manuel Bandemel, 6'4". Not like that. Ramel Lloyd, 6'6". It's not like they're big now.
And Bandemel was supposed to be a defender.
Yes, that's how he thinks of himself. Juwan Gary is the same way. Thinks of himself as a defense first guy. So there's certainly a sizable shift happening here. You hear Trev saying that he wants Fred to make himself uncomfortable. I think we've seen that. This is different.
Now we're going to see if that zone is what they what they think it'll be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. You think they'll run it?
I do think they'll run it. I think they're gonna. I don't think they can run it 1,000% of the time, but I think it'll be their base defense. Yeah.
Interesting.
I think they'll get shot out of it sometimes. You can bleed threes.
That's supposed to trap, right?
Yeah.
In women's college basketball, there's a guy that used to do this. He still coaches. His name is Matt Bowen, and they call it the Buzz defense. That's what they call it there. And Northwestern runs it, too. If you want to watch a women's basketball team do it, they do it. And it's exactly that. It's a zone that all of a sudden morphs into. And what's interesting is that the Nebraska women's basketball team became very, very proficient at beating both of those defenses. They got really good at it.
And what does Nebraska do really well? They shoot threes.
Right. Like, they became... It's very, for what it's worth, for people, it's actually really hard to run zones in women's basketball. The coaching is so good, the shooting is so good, and you don't have players who are so long.
Yeah.
Like a 6'7".
Hard to cover as much ground.
Yeah. It's hard to zone for very long in women's college basketball without getting filleted by a really good team. It's just very hard to do. In men's college basketball, you can try to pull it off. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. All right. That is our podcast for the week. For Evan Bland, I'm Jimmy Watkins.
No, you're not.
You're Jimmy Watkins. I'm Sam McEwen. And we'll be back next week to talk about a huge recruiting weekend. Friday Night Lights. I think it's going to be a new kind of Friday Night Lights. I really do. I was thinking maybe we'll have Chattel come in. Because I think it's time to talk to Tom.
That's a treat.
He doesn't know that I'm going to invite him in. But I think it's time to talk to him just about everything that's been going on with all three of the sports, but particularly football. I think I'd be interested to hear his perspective on what has been a really busy offseason and appears to be, I just can't remember an offseason like this. 5 new coaches, 15 transfers, 32 new players. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
1 year, to get it done. This is bold. We'll see if it works. Thanks for listening, Husker fans.